This is Bad Cop No Donut for the week of March 24th, 2005.
All right, police!
Bad cop.
No donut!
Bad. Cop.
No. Donut.
Because I'm the law, and I rule.
With your weekly wrap-up of North American police brutality, misconduct, and corruption, I'm Ron Anisich at CKLN in Toronto. Stay tuned after this week's headlines for an interview with James Ruggieri, a researcher who gave a presentation to the American Academy of Forensic Science last month, in which he claimed that stun guns can cause delayed cardiac arrests and other ill effects, and that many taser-related injuries to both police officers and civilians may be going undetected. But first, let's have a look at what the police did to us this week. A police officer in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, was arrested this week for kidnapping and rape. According to an Associated Press account, Officer John Jones arrested a woman on a warrant last Tuesday, but failed to take her to jail. After the woman appeared in court, Jones offered to drive her back to work where he had arrested her. Instead, after stopping at the woman's house, the officer drove her to a secluded area where he sexually assaulted her. The officer was also fired last Friday after he was charged.
There was a number of images I describe as child nudity, but there's also a large number of images of child pornography and child abuse. These images depicted children as young as 5 or 6 performing sex acts with adults, both boys and girls. Very disturbing.
A veteran police officer in Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island, was arrested this week on child pornography charges. CBC reports claim that police arrested Officer Clyde Sangster after his name came up in connection with an ongoing child pornography investigation. Police say the computer seized contained images of children as young as 5 or 6 engaged in sex acts with adults. Sangster resigned on March 14th, the same day the officer's home was searched by police. A sheriff's deputy on the Isle of Wight, Virginia, was arrested last week after being indicted for taking sexual liberties with a young girl. According to WAVY-TV, Deputy David Sessoms was accused in October 2004 of taking indecent liberties with a 10-year-old girl in a room at a local shopping mall. Sessoms resigned in January. Up until January, Sessoms had been assigned to teach the DARE program to students at 5 area elementary schools. A police officer in Warwick, New York, was indicted this week on 3 sodomy charges. A report in the Times-Herald Record says that Officer Edward Mullins had sex with a boy who was 16 years old in 1999 after the boy moved in with the officer when he became estranged from his family. Mullins was also charged with falsely reporting an incident after he made a false claim against his accuser. The officer tried to claim that his victim stole his credit card and made a fraudulent purchase with it. An investigation revealed that Mullins' victim could not have possibly committed the crime. Mullins is currently suspended. A police officer in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, was arrested last week for forcing a woman to perform a sex act on him in exchange for not charging her for drug possession. The Associated Press reports that Officer Nicholas Intz is the 6th Milwaukee police officer to be charged with the crime in the last 3 weeks. Intz has been charged with misconduct in office and sexual assault. He was released on bond 2 days after his arrest. Earlier this month, 3 Milwaukee police officers were charged in connection to a brutal beating of a man at a party held at an off-duty officer's home. Another officer was charged with punching a man who was handcuffed and in custody of police. Yet another officer was charged this month for stealing money from a motorist during a traffic stop. A police officer in Los Angeles who was found guilty of fondling a woman and who improperly touched another woman while in uniform was sentenced to 90 days in custody last week. According to the LA Times, Officer Michael Kapalungan was found guilty 1 month ago of sexually assaulting a woman who had called police for help after she was a victim of domestic violence. Kapalungan used the opportunity to touch the woman in an inappropriate manner. He subsequently assaulted an undercover police officer who was posing as a victim of domestic violence. In that incident, the officer was videotaped groping the officer's breasts. In a sentencing memorandum, the judge who delivered the sentence wrote that when a crime victim calls the police, quote, she has the right to expect that she will be treated with respect, that her complaint will be taken seriously and investigated, and that she will not be inappropriately touched for the officer's own pleasure. A police officer in Fostoria, Ohio, was denied bail last week after being charged with a variety of offenses relating to events which occurred 2 years ago. The Seneca County Advertiser Tribune says that Officer Nicholas Portentoso was denied bail after he was charged with assault, disrupting public services, possession of crack cocaine, and intimidation. The officer was accused of pointing a gun at his wife when she told him she wanted a divorce. He then turned the gun on himself. Police say that the officer's DNA was found on the barrel of the gun. Members of the officer's own family testified at the bail hearing that they feared Portentoso. His arraignment is scheduled for March 31st. Police in Yonkers, New York, are investigating two separate incidents of police brutality which occurred on March 12th. The Westchester Journal News reports that in one case, the son of a police officer claims he was beaten by two officers. The man claims he had just parked his father's car when confronted by officers Robert Santobello and Peter Wasico, who forced him to lie in the snow face down. He claims he was then kicked in the shoulder and then beaten with a nightstick after he was handcuffed. The victim was charged with disorderly conduct and resisting arrest. In the second case, a man was beaten unconscious by police after a complaint that the man was drunk and disorderly. The man remains unconscious and on a respirator in hospital. In that case, the victim of the beating was charged with attempted assault, harassment, and disorderly conduct.
All of them talk about Glock 40. Okay, I'm the only one in this room professional enough that I know of to carry the Glock 40. I'm the only one.
A DEA agent in Orlando, Florida, who amused internet viewers by shooting himself in the foot during a gun safety lecture in front of a group of fourth graders, has been suspended for a week without pay. WFTV reports that after the shooting, the tough guy agent continued his lecture by warning kids about the danger of accidental shootings, like the one they had just witnessed. No word yet on any discipline for a second DEA agent, who confirmed that the weapon involved in the accidental shooting was not loaded. An investigation is continuing into the events surrounding the death of a man in Hartford, Michigan, who died after a confrontation with police in November. The Detroit News reports that the man was discovered moving heavy construction machinery onto a highway when he was chased by police into a swampy area. Police then used pepper spray and repeatedly shocked the man with a stun gun before wrestling him into the mud. An autopsy report claimed that the man's nasal and oral cavities were plugged by thick mud. The coroner ruled the death an accident, but the local prosecutor who is investigating the death is waiting for the results of a second autopsy before deciding on how to proceed. A week after two police officers in Staunton were fired, a third officer has been indicted and thrown off the force. The Boston Globe says that Officer Robert Letendre was charged with filing a false report and being an accessory to kidnapping in the case of the arrest of a man in January 2000. Last week, Staunton Police Chief Manuel Cachopa was indicted on three counts in relation to his intimidation of a man and a cover-up of the actions of one of his subordinates. Also last week, Sergeant David Cohen was charged with seven counts, including abusing his position as a police officer, attempted extortion, assault and battery, intimidating a witness, and filing false reports. The officer indicted this week has been ordered not to report for duty. The South Carolina Law Enforcement Academy says they will review 15 cases where officers engaged in misconduct or committed crimes and ended up working in law enforcement regardless. The case came to the attention of authorities after a series of reports in the Charleston Post and Courier, which highlighted cases where police officers with histories of abuse were hired by other departments. The newspaper found that since 2002, three out of every four officers whose conduct was called into question managed to find jobs at other police departments, despite records including drug violations, domestic violence, and multiple firings from other departments. Details of the 15 cases under review are not presently available. A police brutality trial in Palo Alto, California, got underway this week with an opening statement from a district attorney which accused the police of incompetence and of not having justification for pepper spraying and beating their victim. According to a report in the San Francisco Gate, the two officers were accused by the district attorney of beating and spraying the man even though he did not resist them and only exercised his right not to identify himself to the officers. The DA also noted that the two officers had no legal justification for detaining the man. The two officers found the man in his car in an upscale neighborhood. The man was sleeping in his car when confronted by police because he had recently become estranged from his wife. Officers Craig Lee and Michael Kahn claim that they beat the man after he refused to obey their commands. A former police officer from Stamford, Connecticut, was charged with lewd conduct this week after flashing people with a toy banana. According to Associated Press, Officer Arthur Bertana had been on probation for another lewd conduct charge in the past. He was arrested on Saturday for shoving a plush banana toy with a smiley face on it into his pants and flashing passers-by. Bertana has also been charged with breach of peace and interfering with a police officer. A police officer in Mobile, Alabama, who was fired in January for statements he made about hating black people, will be returning to work next week. According to the Mobile Register, the city's personnel board decided to reinstate the officer, Michael Schaefer, after concluding that his punishment was too severe. The officer involved admitted to making the statements in question, but the board decided that a 90-day unpaid suspension was a harsh enough punishment. Schaefer will return to work on April 4th. The police have told homeless people in Kelowna, British Columbia, that they must surrender their shopping carts by April 1st or they will be seized. The CBC reports that local RCMP officers have informed many homeless people in the community that their only means of storage of their belongings will soon be taken away from them. They say they are acting based on complaints from business owners in the community. Anti-poverty activists are understandably outraged by the obvious targeting of the poor and are trying to come up with another storage plan for the homeless before the April 1st deadline. The chief of police in Richmond, Illinois, has been fired. The decision came one day after one of the chief's officers was accused of brutally beating and kicking a man who was already handcuffed. A report in the Northwest Herald says that Chief Roger Shuchik was not fired because of the alleged beating. Instead, they report that the village president says that the chief was fired for insubordination. No other details are presently available.
This is not the way we do business in Kansas City. If people have issues with this police department, they should step up and step up strongly.
Last week, a police officer in Kansas City, Missouri, was charged with stealing money from a motorist after a sting was set up to catch him in the act. An Associated Press account of the story says that Officer Mershon Pope was arrested last week and charged with misconduct in administration of office. Last week, Pope was left alone with an undercover officer who was posing as a Latino driver with a poor command of the English language. The sting revealed that the officer stole money from inside the victim's car and inside the man's wallet. The car and wallet contained marked bills that were later recovered at the officer's home. Pope was suspended with pay for 1 year in 2003 after a man complained that an officer had stolen almost $1,000 from him at a traffic stop. Pope was not charged at the time because the victim was unable to identify the officer. A state trooper in Lisbon, Connecticut, has been suspended for inappropriate remarks he made when someone called 911 for help. The Associated Press says that when the trooper, Robert Paisley, answered a call informing him of an accident, which turned out to be fatal, he said, "Too bad," before hanging up on the caller. Paisley was suspended for 15 days on Monday. The caller repeated the call for help until he spoke with an officer who dispatched help, believing that he had dialed the wrong number on his initial attempt. Next up, a review of this week's Taser News.
It was the worst experience I have ever had in my life. I don't want to see anybody ever go through anything like that.
He's my friend, and seeing him there, like, on the ground screaming like that, just...
I don't remember anything. I just have dreams about it every now and then.
He couldn't understand why they were treating him this way, because he hadn't been drinking, he hadn't been doing anything, and he wasn't hurting anybody.
Obviously, it raises a question of lack of training. It raises a bigger question of lack of judgment.
And then all these copper wires that were coming off his back, I had no clue what they were.
The wife of a man who died after being shot with a taser twice by police in Washington in February 2004 has filed a claim against Kitsap County, accusing them of improper use of a taser. The claim seeks $2 million in damages. A coroner in San Mateo County, California, has determined that a stun gun was a factor in the death of a man in Pacifica in January. The victim died in hospital hours after being shot by police with a stun gun. Police in Putnam County, Florida, used tasers on high school students twice this week to break up fights. This week, Taser International introduced a modified version of their stun guns, which increases the range of the weapon. The new version allows metal barbs to be fired into a victim from as far as 35 feet away. The barbs are attached to the taser by a pair of 35-foot wires. The new units will be available beginning this spring. This week, former New York City Police Commissioner Bernard Carrick resigned from the board of Taser International effective April 1st. The day before Carrick quit, it was reported that he made $6.2 million by exercising stock options he obtained as a member of the Taser board. It is now acknowledged by the company that they hire paid duty officers to sell their weapons and say that these officers are responsible for large numbers of sales to North American police departments. Critics were concerned about a potential conflict of interest faced by the officers hired by Taser International. Now, even greater concerns are being raised because the company admits it gave stock options to some of the active duty officers in question. Critics are now alarmed at the possibility of a conflict of interest and wonder whether officers are disclosing the fact that they are Taser employees when they are making their presentations to police departments. An Associated Press report this week examined one Chandler, Arizona officer, Jim Halstead, who did not reveal during his presentation on Taser's behalf that he was being paid by the company. The same officer was given stock options worth over $300,000 when Taser stocks were at their peak value. He was also given a trip to Hawaii worth more than $3,000 by the company. A police officer in Minneapolis quit his job after questions arose about his relationship with Taser. That officer, Ron Belindier, is now Taser's Midwest Regional Sales Manager. This week, two of the Department of Homeland Security's largest law enforcement divisions decided against adding tasers to their arsenal, citing safety concerns. A ban on the devices is now in place for both Immigration and Customs Enforcement and Customs and Border Inspection. The ban will keep tasers out of the hands of almost 20,000 agents and officers. Police in Sweetwater, Florida, have decided that all of the department's uniformed officers will carry the weapon. The sheriff's office in Rockingham County, North Carolina, have decided to go ahead with their planned taser purchase after they received a grant to pay for the devices. Police in Salem, Oregon, have decided to add tasers to their arsenal. 30 tasers will be purchased immediately, and plans are in place to have the entire force armed with stun guns by next year. A bill is being moved through the state legislature of New Mexico that would certify tasers as a deadly weapon. If successful, police in that state would face severe restrictions regarding when they could use the weapons. Other than the killings already mentioned in this program, police also killed people this week in Chicago, Illinois, Seattle, Washington, Tomahawk, Wisconsin, Essex, Maryland, Rock Hill, South Carolina, Portland, Oregon, and Butler, Pennsylvania. Last month, James Ruggieri of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers gave a presentation to the American Academy of Forensic Science where he alleged that stun guns had the potential to cause cardiac arrests hours after they are used. Many police officers who have volunteered to be shocked by tasers, which incapacitate subjects using a 50,000 volt jolt of electricity, may have been injured and not even know it. The same is true for the thousands of people who the police have used their tasers on in the line of duty. I spoke earlier with Ruggieri from his home in Virginia.
The science is based on medical research. There were two separate researchers in published medical journals, peer-reviewed medical journals, that came up with those findings with respect to the delayed onset of ventricular fibrillation. It was related to low voltage. When I say low voltage, meaning generally voltage under 600 volts, in these particular cases that the researchers evaluated, there happened to have been line current, residential line of voltage of about 120 volts. And what they found in one researcher's case is that they had he had three individuals who presented symptoms following low-voltage shock across the thoracic region that culminated, delayed, in ventricular fibrillation. In one case, it was up to 12 hours following exposure of an individual to electric shock.
To put it into layman's terms, you're talking about a heart attack.
Well, it's the precursor to a heart attack. What happens in ventricular fibrillation is the two lower quadrants of the heart. The heart is basically a bag segregated into four compartments. The two lower compartments are your ventricles, and those are the sections of the heart that are the business end. They actually do the pumping. They're the pumping generators, if you will, that pushes blood into the body.
Okay.
So when you have ventricular fibrillation, what's happening is that the two lower quadrants are quivering. They're not syncopated with the other, the top two, which are the atrium quadrants that supply blood to the ventricles. Blood doesn't flow. You have inadequate perfusion of the human tissue because the ventricles are quivering. They're not cooperating with each other. It's sort of like milking a cow. You have to guide the blood from one segment to the next. When the ventricles are fibrillating or shaking uncooperatively, what happens is that blood doesn't pump not only to the human tissue, the arms, the head, but to the heart itself. So the heart is starved for oxygenated blood, and that generally manifests in what's known as a heart attack.
Now, when the ventricles are functioning properly, there is some kind of electrical impulse. Is that correct, or am I way off base?
No, yeah, that's correct. Generally, there's an electrical impulse provided generally by the brain, which travels across the heart in such a fashion that the four quadrants are stimulated cooperatively, such that the blood moves from one section of the heart to the next, and then to the next.
So you mentioned that these the research that was done earlier was done on a normal household current, which is 120 volts, less than 600 volts, you said.
Yes.
Tasers shock people with 50,000 volts, and my understanding is that there are a number of different, there's another variable at work here, because 50,000 volts, people hear that, and it's quite alarming.
Yes, 50,000 or 50 kilovolts is quite a large voltage. Generally, one doesn't see those type of voltage, aside from perhaps static electricity or lightning. Typically, it's transmission voltage. Of course, transmission voltages can go well in excess of that, but 50,000 volts is not something that the average individual will see day to day. That's quite a bit of voltage.
Does it compare to a cattle prod or an electric fence or any of the existing presumably safe devices that are on the market? Or
Well, generally the cattle prods are less voltage. 50,000 volts as provided by the taser sits on the high end of the scale for electroshock devices. Cattle prods, depending on the units that are available, it does vary from manufacturer to manufacturer. Typically, they can range from 2,000 volts to perhaps 10,000 volts. It's rare that you see anything beyond 15,000 volts.
Why do they feel it necessary to use 50,000 volts in a taser?
Well, I suspect that taser's rationale for the high voltage is to overcome the impedance of clothing. Generally, when you're dealing with a cattle or an animal, they do have fur, but they don't have the type of clothing that one might see, particularly in the winter climates, of coats and perhaps vests, shirts, T-shirts. Those are relatively insulating materials, and when asked about the need for the high voltage, Taser has always proffered the intention of the need to break down the insulating barrier provided by clothing. Certainly one would need a lot less voltage to do what the taser does if the assumption is that the individual's without clothing, if they're naked, perhaps.
Right. So in this equation, that the probes, that the darts that are attached to the taser presumably would not need to be deployed. Because my thinking has always been that they get you through the clothes by, piercing them with those barbed darts.
Well, that's true. But depending on the thickness of clothing, the barbed darts, they do resemble miniature harpoons, and they've been likened to straightened fish hooks. Depending on the thickness of the clothing will determine how much of those darts will bury into the skin, into the human tissue.
Now, Taser International, the company that's taken exception to this one claim, at least, of yours, is calling your claim, I believe the exact word was ludicrous, that I read in the Arizona Republic.
Well, they did identify one of my claims as ludicrous. It wasn't the delayed onset of ventricular fibrillation. There were four items that were presented during my paper. I think their ludicrous claim was related to the issue of standards, which standards applied. In my paper or the presentation identified that Taser misapplied the provisions of UL 69 or Underwriters Laboratory. It's a third-party testing institution here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Not too dissimilar to CSA in your country,
right.
The Canadian Standards Association, which performs third-party testing, but UL promulgates standards that are used primarily in the area of electrical safety. I identified that the basis of Taser's claims with respect to that UL standard were faulty. Of course, Taser came out, as you just indicated, and stated that my finding was ludicrous, but in the March 5th Arizona Republic, I think that issue was put to bed with UL stating that Taser misapplied the UL standard, and what was interesting is that they were told repeatedly prior, at least a month prior to the presentation of the paper by UL, that they were misapplying the standard, yet they continued to use that standard on that basis.
There are other problems with tasers and the science behind their testing in particular. One thing that I came across in your presentation that I thought bore some explanation was whether nerves and muscles were affected by the charge delivered from the taser. Now, my understanding is that Taser International says no.
Well, this is the issue with respect to skin effect.
Okay.
Skin effect is an electrical phenomenon that says that as frequency increases in a conductor, that the current or the charge current carriers tend to push to the outer surface. One of the claims by the medical director of Taser, Dr. Stratbucker, when asked about the Taser current penetrating deep into the tissue, such as to harm the fetus, stated that skin effect would prevent the current from penetrating deep into human tissue. My findings are that we don't have the requisite frequency with the Taser device necessary to invoke skin effect phenomenon. Therefore, and in fact, it's two or three orders of magnitude below what would be required in biological material. Generally, to see skin effect in biological material, one would need about 10 million cycles or in excess of 10 million cycles. The highest frequency present with the Taser, particularly with the M26, is approximately 50 kilocycles. So that was one of the first engineering errors I uncovered early on in my research with respect to safety claims and the engineering basis for the Taser.
Could you explain a little more about what this skin effect is?
Skin effect is an electrical phenomenon that states that as frequency increases, the charge carriers through a conductor tend to push towards the surface of the conductor. I think I provided you with the presentation,
yes,
which provides somewhat of a graphic of that, where the current density is shown around the outer periphery of a conductor. With respect to the Taser device, the claim by Stratbucker is as the frequency is so high that the skin effect occurs and current tends to flow in the outer surfaces of the human body, namely in the skin. That's a fallacy. I don't know if that helps you with the definition. It's easily shown in the mathematics, but I know it doesn't help you here.
Okay. Well, I'll defer to your expertise in that case.
Okay.
I noticed also in the presentation the word pulse comes up in a way which is confusing to me. Could you explain the frequency of the pulse? Is this the 10 million cycles you were referring to earlier, or no?
Well, 10 million cycles is what's required to produce any skin effect phenomenon in human tissue.
Right.
The pulse width of the Taser is approximately 10 microseconds, which equates roughly to about 50 kilohertz. When we're speaking about pulse width or pulses with the Taser, what we're referring to is the time on of the current versus time off. So it's in engineering terms, we're looking at a steep wavefront pulse that comes up to voltage very, very quickly. It's a very abrupt change from zero. It comes up very quickly, unlike a household current, which is graduated, is a linear, smooth linear relation, generally known as a sinusoidal waveform. But this is one can treat this pulse width as a frequency component with the Taser device.
Okay. Now, the frequency, what relevance does this have then with the weapon compared to, I believe that you compared it to an electric fence in your presentation?
Well, the electric fence analogy came out of the earlier studies, approximately 1976, with the Consumer Product Safety Commission. At that time, they had no other basis. There was very little literature with respect to the effects of steep wavefront pulses on humans. The only item or the only literature they had to go on was application of cattle fences. These are fences used to keep livestock away from the from escaping. Basically, it's a wire fence, and electric current is provided, pulses on this fence, such that if a cattle or a sheep come into contact with the fence, they're jolted back and therefore discouraged from trying that again. This was the early testing by the Consumer Product Safety Commission, I believe it was Dr. Theodore Bernstein, that evaluated the earlier TASER model. This was the TASER Public Defender. It was a 7-watt model in contrast to the 26-watt model output of the M26 present TASER device. And they found that the TASER device, pulsating at 13 pulses per second, was approximately 13 times stronger than the earlier TASER model. So I identified the electric fence simply because the nature of the graph provided by TASER used or attempted to use some of the information from this early document regarding cattle fences. In reality, the analogy is lost, and the device is far, far stronger, particularly the new M26 or the newer M26 TASER model with respect to cattle fences. It's a very poor testing contrast used by the TASER company.
I understand that many coroners, including the deputy chief coroner here in the province of Ontario, is reluctant to say that tasers are responsible for any deaths because of a widely held belief that an electrical shock kills you immediately and is not capable of killing you at a later time. First of all, do I have that straight?
That's you have that straight. That's correct. That is a in some circles that has been a widely held belief. However, my research in uncovering those two particular papers, research papers, shows that's not the case. That we can have delayed death or delayed ventricular fibrillation many hours following exposure to electric shock or following exposure to a taser. The coroners, I believe that they found that to be the most compelling element of my presentation, in which case, from what I understand, many coroners now are reevaluating their protocol in determining death due to electric shock, in which case it may result in reevaluation of previous determinations where the taser was precluded based on that fallacy. Hopefully that'll come to pass.
Are you aware of this case this week in Pacifica, California, where a taser was ruled a contributing factor to the cause of death of an individual who was killed there in January?
Yes, I read about that today, that it was just released today, the coroner's findings that did determine. That case is a good example because the individual was tased, and there was some time lag from the time that he was tased to when he was non-responsive. That would be a good application, although we can take that many hours after tasing.
Has there been any research done on the effect of the length of time somebody is shot with a taser? Now, the reason I ask this is because in the literature I've seen from Taser International, it seems as though they are insisting that people are shocked for a duration of 5 seconds or less, and that's their safety guideline. However, it appears that it is possible to use a taser for a substantially longer period of time. I'm thinking of a case in Indiana a few weeks ago where a teenager was shocked I believe, 14 times within a 12-minute period, sometimes for a duration of 14 seconds, according to the cartridge, the data kept by Taser's cartridge.
Right, the black box one is able to download. That's a good question. The longer duration one is exposed to Taser pulses, the greater the likelihood of suffering some heart problems, of ventricular fibrillation. One of the research findings that another element that came out during my presentation was offered was the research findings that subsequent pulses serve to reduce the ventricular fibrillation threshold. In the case of steep wavefront pulses, the research shows that following six pulses, the ventricular fibrillation threshold drops by a factor of 30. Now, given the Taser is a weapon that cycles at a rate of 19 cycles per second, for the minimum five-second duration where the suspect or patient is exposed to approximately 95 cycles, that is far in excess of the six pulses used emanating from my research.
I guess what I'm concerned about overall in terms of the big picture is how are they getting away with this? It seems to me that they're building these weapons that clearly, at least anecdotally, if not scientifically, are linked to a certain number of deaths. And they're making claims as outrageous as Tasers are not responsible for any deaths.
Well, you know, they say they're getting away with it. Therein lies, I don't know how immune they are from this issue. Over here in the United States, there's approximately 20 to 25 class action lawsuits filed against the Taser company. One element in each of those 25 deals with this issue of misrepresentation of product. There's probably about another 20 product liability, wrongful death, or product defect lawsuits, plaintiff actions against Taser, where folks have been hurt, and again, all containing the element of misrepresentation of product. You have to realize that the Taser, as marketed by the manufacturer, is very desirable. The concept is very desirable to police officers because it's something that they can restrain an individual at arm's length. The concept itself does make it safer for the police officers, and it's something that the police officers prefer. Certainly, one doesn't want to engage with an irrational suspect, particularly if the suspect is much larger, if they can avoid that. But they've been sold a bill of goods. They've been led to believe that the Taser is so safe that here in the United States, there's been many instances where folks have been tased that normally wouldn't suffer any type of physical force or the minimal amount of physical force, for instance, six-year-olds or the very elderly. So I think the chickens have come home to roost lately, particularly since the presentation I provided on February 25th. It seemed to have gotten a lot of attention and it's perked up a lot of ears. So I think the police jurisdictions are looking with a jaundiced eye towards Taser and now starting to question the veracity of the information provided by them.
One other question I had for you is, and it also came up in your presentation, was that at a range of 21 feet, these barbs that shoot out of the Tasers have a propensity to not reach their target, or I forget the language you used in your presentation, but there's a 2-foot margin of error at the 20-foot range, right?
Yeah, generally, as one is as you increase the distance between the Taser unit and the suspect, the spread between the barbs increases. At 21 feet, the spread between the barbs is approximately 2 feet. So ostensibly, if the first barb or one barb flies straight and hits the individual in the region, let's say at the base of the neck, you can expect the other barb to hit somewhere around the lower abdomen, around the belly button region, coinciding with the 2 foot spread. That's problematic in the sense that you're not always going to place the barbs on the suspect where you want, and the accuracy is not all that great. It's a pneumatic weapon. It's not a rifled projectile, and you generally point in roughly in the area you want to hit, the center of mass, but you really don't have any control where those barbs go. I mean, it's possible you can hit someone in the eye or in the face or some area other than what one would intend to hit.
I'm guessing with the introduction of the new model this week that says it shoots with a range of 35 feet, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that this is going to be an even bigger problem.
That's a possibility. Again, the accuracy on these devices isn't all that great. But the question becomes, at how far of a distance does a police officer need to place himself from the suspect? Generally, arm's length is acceptable, provided they're not holding a long baseball bat. 10 feet would probably be ideal, and that's presently what's being recommended by the manufacturer, 7-10 foot distance.
Are you concerned at all about the new civilian model of Taser that's been introduced?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I have a great deal of concern for this civilian model. Reportedly, what Taser has offered to the civilian community with their new civilian model is the feature that one can stroke the device so it can remain on for 30 seconds, such that the user can hit the suspect, lay the device on the ground, and provide 30 seconds of time to run away. As we identified earlier, with increasing pulses, you increase the likelihood of ventricular fibrillation, and with 30 seconds, something's bound to happen. I think you'll see a great deal of folks, consumer folks, civilian-related deaths when the Taser is deployed. And also there's the issue of abuse. These devices could be used by the criminal element or by folks that have simply been led to believe that these devices are safe. You might see them used in schools, spousal abuse issues. I don't see that much of a value for these devices in the civilian community. And the only exception, perhaps, would be maybe in airplanes in terms of airplane security in the event of hijack. Certainly, you don't want a ballistic weapon to penetrate the pressure bulkhead of a plane. So the Taser might be of value in that particular arena. But I don't see Joe homeowner waking up in the middle of the night in response to a disturbance and grabbing his Taser in lieu of a shotgun.
You know, these weapons are being used by school security and the police in schools. And in fact, this week, two teenage high school students were shot with a Taser. Last week, same thing. You mentioned children as young as 6. Has there been any research into the effects on the hearts of children?
Well, generally, there's been some general research of the effects of electrical shock as a function of body weight. And intuitively, it's as you guess, is that the smaller the individual, the more susceptible they are. Of course, larger folks, all else being equal, are less susceptible to the effects of electrical shock. So the impacts of a Taser on a small body, say a 6-year-old or a 13-year-old, can have greater risks and greater implications, sure.
Thanks very much for speaking to me. I really appreciate it a lot.
Thank you for the invitation. I appreciate it.
That's all for this week. Tune into this station next week for more. Email your comments and story ideas to ron@ckln.fm. Thanks to everyone who sent articles for this week's show. From CKLN 88.1 FM in Toronto, I'm Ron Anisich. Every week we end Bad Cop, No Donut with the song. This week it's Law and Order by Stiff Little Fingers.